You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 164 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Value of Thinking for a Cognition that Satisfies the Human Being. 11 lectures translated by Christian von Arnim. This is the fourth lecture, given in Dornach on the 20th of September, 1915. In the last 2 days I have spoken to you of how the human being's cognition, which they must acquire as earth human beings on the physical plane, is at first a kind of dead cognition, a cognition which relates to what we must call the cognition of the next higher world, in the same way as what is dead relates to what is alive. I've tried to illustrate how this dead, as it were, mechanical knowledge of the physical earthly human being comes alive when we want to rise to those levels of cognition through which the human being can learn something of the so-called higher worlds. Dead cognition. However, even as physical earthly cognition, it has not always been as dead as cognition is today, but it has only become so. And you all know the time when human earth cognition became so dead. I have often spoken to you of how, if we go back to ancient times, to times of earth evolution before the mystery of Golgotha had taken place, ordinary earthly cognition was also more alive because there was a kind of ancient heritage of higher cognition. Something of the ancient heritage of a higher cognition was always mixed into the ordinary earthly cognition. You can follow this in the various epistemological and religious documents of humanity. Just look at how in the Bible, in the Old Testament, where the supersensory worlds are spoken of, there is always talk either of a dream or of the inspirations of the prophets. There we always have a natural return to living cognition. The old atavistic inheritance of clairvoyance, left to human beings as a moon heritage, had not yet been extinguished. This became extinguished at the time of the mystery of Golgotha. I ask you to take this sentence very precisely, for if one of you quotes this sentence somewhere in such a way that you report that I said that through the mystery of Golgotha the old atavistic knowledge was extinguished, you are saying the exact opposite of what I have just expressed. At the time of the mystery of Golgotha, this knowledge was extinguished through the quite natural course of development of humanity, and the mystery of Golgotha brought a substitute for what had gradually been lost, brought life into the human soul from another side. So that today we are faced with the following fact. We can go back into ancient human records on earth, where we find all kinds of scientific things, even before the time of the mystery of Golgotha, but in this science, the ancient people did not presume anything that was cognition of what was supreme and most important for human beings, but it was basically more subordinate things that were believed to be understood in this way. Everything that was important, everything that related to the supersensory worlds, was traced back to ancient wisdom, to a wisdom that was given to humanity, as it were, through a primal revelation. You can see this expressed in one of our four mysteries, and it was presented in such a way that this heritage was then passed on from generation to generation in the wisdom schools. As early as in the book titled Christianity as Mystical Fact, you will find that we try to understand how, through the mystery of Golgotha, a substitute was created for this dying old wisdom, how we might say that the primal mystery became an historical fact on Golgotha, and how through the fact that the cross of initiation was set up on Golgotha for all people to see, life was to be poured into the human soul. So that since then we can say, there is our dead knowledge, which the human being gains through their own effort on the physical plane, and there is alongside it something that flows into their soul through the fact that through the mystery of Golgotha, The substance which was to enter the earth aura through Christ flowed out into the earth aura and now flows into the human soul as a second source of human cognition. So that we can say, from the spiritual scientific point of view, the matter must be regarded in such a way that the human being's physical knowledge of the earth is a dead one, but that life enters into it when the human being allows their physical knowledge of the earth to be fertilized by that which the mystery of Golgotha can be for them. And then we have the next higher level of cognition, which we call imaginative cognition. This is already something living, something truly living. And this living cognition, this imaginative cognition, is about the things we have been discussing in the last few days. Today I would like to emphasize once again as something important what I said yesterday, that this imaginative cognition is still related to the nature of the human soul. It is a return to the moon period. And it is related to the nature of the human soul in such a way that indeed, in human nature today, as I described yesterday, the old dreamlike moon cognition can again emerge atavistically, and that some things which can also be understood through a higher clairvoyant skill can, we might say, come together with what emerges through atavism, if the moon clairvoyant has the necessary modesty. But further removed from the human being than imaginative cognition is everything that enters their soul in an inspirational way, through inspiration. For these are, in substance, the facts of the old sun evolution, with which the human being was connected. And that which the human being absorbed as an element of life during the old evolution of the sun, that too is preserved down there in the depths of human nature. This must be illuminated through conscious cognition if inspiration is to occur. I indicated yesterday that in real, in true art, there is an unconscious drawing forth of these things which belong to the facts of the old sun, and which human beings have preserved as their heritage. That when what lies deep in the hidden depths of the soul is lifted up into the conscious life of the soul, it can rise to human consciousness as artistic inspiration. The human being then lives only in the consequences that come up from below. They do not live in the causes. If I have already had to indicate to you that the thought below the threshold of consciousness is very different from the thought we have when we bring something up again into consciousness from the subconscious thoughts through memory, it must be emphasized that what in truth lives in the depths of the artist's soul is even more different, radically different, from that which then rises up into the consciousness of the artist. Now we must inscribe one characteristic quite acutely into our souls if we are to understand the whole of inspiration at all. You see, for the human being who is touched by the inspiration, there is no difference between an objective law of nature and that which they experience in their soul as a thought, as an experience of the soul. They feel the law of nature as belonging to them, just as they feel that which lives in their own soul as belonging to them. Let me put it this way. If the person to whom inspiration comes decides to do something, if they do something out of some motive, there is an underlying lawfulness. This lawfulness, we are initially empowered to feel it as a law of our own breast, as an experience of our own. But we feel it with the same objectivity as we feel the rising of the sun, as an objective law. I can also put it like this. When I pick up my watch, I feel that it is my affair on the physical plane. With physical cognition, I will not feel it to be my affair when the sun rises in the morning. But in relation to what really comes from the impulse of the inspired world, we feel what happens in nature as belonging to ourselves. Human interest really does extend across the affairs of nature. The affairs of nature become the human being's own interests. As long as we do not feel the life of the plant within us to be as familiar as the experiences of our own heart, there can be no truth in inspiration. As long as we do not feel a falling stone splashing on the surface of the water, and making drops spray up in the same way as we can feel what is going on in our own being, for as long inspiration does not accord with the truth. I could also put it like this. Everything in the human being that lies closer to them than to nature in its fullness, that does not belong to the inspired truths. However, it would be complete nonsense to believe that the inspired person, when someone breaks their skull, would feel this just as objectively as they feel the eruption of a volcano. Subjectively, they of course make this distinction, but they do not possess an inspiration at the moment when someone breaks their skull. But for everything that in this sense belongs to the field of inspiration, their interest is extended across the whole of nature. And I have already drawn attention in the Hague cycle to how the extension of interest is what matters in extended cognition in the first place. Anyone who cannot escape from what concerns them alone, at least for a short time, can naturally not come to any inspiration. They don't always need to do it, of course. On the contrary, they will do well to sharply demarcate their own interests from what should be the object of their inspiration. But if the human being thus extends their interest beyond objectivity, if they try to feel the life of the plant as it comes into being, in the same way as they feel that which is going on in their own life, if that which grows and sprouts and comes into being and passes away out there is as intimately familiar to them as the life in their own being, then they are inspired with regard to everything that approaches them in this way. But then this way of being interested is necessarily linked with a gradual ascent to such a judgment of human beings as we have indicated that the Goethean judgment of human beings gradually became. Goethe learned to distinguish between the human being's actions and the human being's essence through his striving for living thoughts. And this is something exceptionally important. What we do or have done belongs to the objective world. Is karma at work? What we are as a personality is constantly in development. And the judgment we make about something a person has done must basically be on a completely different page from the judgment we make about the value or lack of value of a human personality. We must, if we wish to approach the higher worlds, learn to be able to face the human personality as objectively as we face a plant or a stone objectively. We must learn to be able to empathize also with the personality of those people who have done deeds that we must perhaps condemn in the most profound sense. It is precisely the separation of the human being from their deeds, the separation of the human being also from their karma, that we must be able to accomplish if we want to be able to gain a correct relationship with the higher worlds. And here again, if we want to place ourselves truly on the ground of spiritual science, we must see that this is one of the cases where we come into sharp contradiction with the materialistic thinking of our time. For this materialistic thinking of our time has a tendency to draw the personality of the person more and more into the judgment of their deeds. Just think that in recent times, in the field of external jurisprudence, the tendency has increasingly developed that when a person has committed a certain act, we should not only judge the act, but that we should also observe the whole of human nature, that we should take into account the psyche of a person, how they came to do it, the act, whether they are inferior or perfect, and so on. And certain circles are even demanding from external jurisprudence that not only doctors should be consulted as experts regarding the assessment of offenses and crimes, but even psychologists. But it is arrogance to judge the nature of a person rather than the deeds, which are solely concerned with external life. Among the more recent philosophers, only one has shown some attention on this ground. You will also find him mentioned in my title, The Riddles of Philosophy, albeit with regard to different aspects. It was Dilthey who drew attention to the fact that jurisprudence must again get away from psychological jurisprudence and everything similar. What a person does concerns two areas. Firstly, their karma. This, through its causation, already produces its own judgments. It is no one else's business. Christ himself did not judge the sin of the adulteress, but inscribed it in the ground, because it will live itself out in the course of karma. Secondly, human deeds relate to human coexistence, and the human deed should only be judged from this perspective. It is not up to the external social order to judge human beings as such. But spiritual science will gradually rise to something other than judging. It will rise to understanding. And those psychologists who could be appointed today to function as experts when judging a person's external acts will be of no use, for they won't yet know anything about a person's soul. The assessment of a person should not correspond to judgment, but to understanding. Because helping and not judging should be the tendency under all circumstances. Helping, not judging. But we can only help if we have an understanding of what is going on in a human soul. However, if we have the tendency to help in truthfulness and not in lies, we will be greatly misunderstood by the world. For the person who is to be helped will be at least inclined also to judge in the right way the person who wants to help in the right way. The person who is to be helped will want to be helped in the way they think. But that may be the worst help you can give them, if you help them in the way they think they should be helped. An understanding gained on the basis of the soul and spiritual life will often lead us not to do for the person we want to help precisely what they presuppose we should do for them, but to do something quite different for them. Maybe even sometimes withdrawing from such a person will be the much better help than cajoling. The brusque rejection of something will be a much better, more loving help than the flattering accommodation and acceptance of what the person in question wants. Someone can be much more loving toward a person by treating them severely under certain circumstances than someone who gives in to them in every way. And there will, of course, be misapprehension in this field. That is quite natural. Perhaps it is precisely the person who makes the greatest effort to engage with a person's soul in this way who is most misunderstood. But that's not what matters. It's seeking understanding in all circumstances, not being a judge. In the context of our spiritual scientific lectures, we often had to speak of Ahriman and Lucifer. Of course, especially after the observations that have been made recently, we can see how human nature can be gripped by Ahriman and Lucifer to a greater or lesser extent. For basically, life as such is a pendulum swinging back and forth between Ahrimanic and Luciferic impulses, only that the position of equilibrium is sought by the being of the world itself, and life consists precisely in maintaining this position of equilibrium. But now consider a tremendous distinction. We can do two things. We can pass judgment that some act of a person is Ahrimanically or Luciferically influenced, and we can judge the person accordingly. Or we can do something else. We can realize that a deed of a person is Ahrimanically or Luciferically influenced, and from this fact we can try to understand the person. And there is the greatest conceivable difference between these two judgments. For to judge that there is something Ahrimanic or Luciferic in a person requires that this judgment should never be made from any other point of view than this, that people should no more be judged according to this knowledge that Ahriman and Lucifer live in a person than a plant should be judged because it blossoms red and not blue. Any kind of judicial judgment must be excluded from the idea that anything in a person is Ahrimanic or Luciferic, just as the making of any value judgment must be excluded from our judgment if we want to recognize the plant, be it red or blue. Above all, we must seek to keep cognition pure from all emotion, from all subjectivity. And we will be able to do this increasingly the more we make an effort to do so, the more we really strive to take such things as have just been said with the utmost seriousness. Goethe, for example, was concerned, especially in his most mature period, to present events between people as if they were natural occurrences. Not, of course, from the point of view as if a mechanical necessity were inherent both in a human context and in a natural context. There can be no question of that. But the position of the human soul in relation to the events in human life will gradually become such that with the same objective love as we look at natural events, we will also allow the events in human life to apply with regard to cognition. This provides the inner tolerance that comes from cognition itself. In this way, however, we acquire the possibility of gradually allowing that to flow into cognition which otherwise must not flow into cognition at all, namely the terminology which arises out of feeling and the will. When I explained psychoanalysis to you, we concluded one day in particular by having to speak damning words about it. But we first showed that this followed from the matter itself. And why could this judgment be passed? Here I may also say something subjective. Why did I presume to pronounce a seemingly entirely subjective judgment about psychoanalysis? Because I made an effort, I am saying something subjective, but then it means that things are perhaps most easily understood, to study psychoanalysis in the way that I study something that is very pleasant for me and that I like a lot. That is, to show the same objective love to one as to the other. And to this we must gradually work our way, really work our way. Otherwise we seek nothing but sensation in cognition. We seek only what is pleasant in cognition. But we never have cognition if we seek only what is pleasant in cognition. For our physical life, the sun-like never enters the consciousness of the human being in any other way than by pleasing them or repelling them. Only feelings enter from the sun-like. And we must meet the sun-like with our understanding. We must penetrate down into that which is otherwise foreign to the human being. We said that the moon-like is related to the human being, but the sun-like is no longer related to the human being. We must take down, carry down our understanding into regions we do not otherwise penetrate, if we want to make what is sun-like in inspiration accessible to us. The real cognition of the higher worlds does indeed demand preparation in the whole mood of our soul, and without this mood in the soul, we cannot penetrate into the higher worlds. I do not mean now merely to penetrate clairvoyantly, but also to pursue things with understanding. We cannot understand the things told in title Occult Science if we wish to absorb them in the frame of mind we usually have for something outwardly neutral, that is to say, for something mathematical or the like. But we can only absorb them if we first prepare ourselves for them in our minds. The person who wants to absorb inspired cognition with the ordinary understanding of the physical plane is like the person who believes that they can crawl into a plant with their physical body and thus be inside its life. That is why the attempt was always made to prepare human beings before giving them knowledge of the higher worlds, to prepare them gradually, so that the mood of the soul was such that such cognition of the higher worlds could have an effect on the mind in the right way. They inevitably had an effect on the mind, for this particular way of facing the higher world requires a certain exertion of the mind, a certain cohesion, a gathering of the inner soul forces. It requires that, above all, we should not be surprised that a certain inner effort is necessary in order to face the cognition of the higher worlds in the right way. Hence, it is necessary for the human being to create a counterbalance, a proper counterbalance, such that it allows them to tip the scales the other way, as it were, in their soul. We have to consider the matter very carefully. If you make an effort in the soul, and you must if you really want to grasp the spiritual worlds, even only those things which are given from the spiritual worlds, you can't follow a lecture about the spiritual worlds if you don't listen carefully, if you don't make an effort with your soul. If you really try hard to understand what is said about the spiritual world, you feel that you have to make an effort. You shouldn't then be surprised about that. You shouldn't have to say, well, that is very demanding. Because it is natural that it is very demanding. But if it is so demanding, then, as long as we are human beings on earth, a consequence will naturally result. And this consequence is that egoism is aroused in the human being. The more the human being feels themselves within themselves, the stronger is their egoism. Take simply the most common phenomenon. As long as we go through the world in good health, we are unegoistic with regard to the physical body. The moment we fall ill, when everything hurts, we become selfish in relation to the external body. That is quite natural. And it is simply nonsensical to demand of the ill person that they should not be selfish in relation to their illness. That is simply nonsense. And if someone says, I may be ill, but I accept my illness selflessly, that is, of course, just a pretense and untrue words. But it is the same when we go through this effort in the soul which is necessary in order to work our way up into the higher worlds, to climb up. There you also get into the egoistic element. We should not deceive ourselves, but rather, if we want to penetrate this world, we should hold the truth up to ourselves. We have to say to ourselves, you are working yourself into a mood of egoism if you want to enter the higher worlds, because you have to feel these efforts within yourself. I would like to compare this way of working our way into the higher worlds with something. I would like to compare it with a particular kind of artistic activity, such as was present in our friend Christian Morgenstern. This certain singular way, I have often highlighted it, was different with Morgenstern than with other poets. When he worked his way into serious matter, it happened with him in a different way from other poets. It carried him personally up into the region of seriousness to a much greater degree. Therefore, he needed a counterweight, something like in the Gallows Song. Quote, ein Wiesel, a weasel, saß auf einem Kiesel, sat on a pebble, inmitten Backgriesel, amidst a trickling brook. Wisst ihr weshalb? Do you know why? Das Mondkalb, the moon calf, verriet es mir, revealed it to me, im Stillen, quietly. Das raffinierte Tier, the cunning animal, tat's des Reimes willen, did it for the rhyme. Close quote. These light poems, these satirical poems, that's what he needed, as a counterweight, for balance. Those who can always poetically pull a long face, in quotes, who look up sentimentally into the higher worlds, those are not the true poets. The true ones are those who need the counterweight, the antithesis. Now, however, we do look everywhere, do we not, for the possibility of understanding that which must accompany the striving up into the higher worlds as the phenomenon of egoism? You must not judge egoism when it occurs in such a region, because you have to understand it like a natural phenomenon. You must not possess the egoism of always wanting to get rid of egoism, because then you are not real. For example, we create the counterpart in relation to some things through the exercises entitled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved? Initially, the inner counterparts. But also in what we have created as eurythmy, there is a kind of counterpart in the specific way of bringing the etheric body into its appropriate movements and gaining an understanding of this whole language of the human being. It will encourage young people in particular, in a natural way, to live their way into the spiritual realm. But something that must be emphasized on this occasion is that one element should be particularly sought after by the person who really wants to gain a right relationship with the spiritual worlds. That is the element, don't be surprised at this, but it must also be clearly expressed for once, or at least expressed more clearly than has otherwise always happened, that is the element of humor. It is really necessary not to be humorless with regard to the striving for the higher world. Such a humorless stance is what produces such terrible excesses. For if the person who imagines themselves to be Homer or Socrates or Goethe were to realize how infinitely ridiculous they should feel in this role, then this would help them tremendously in curing their views. But only those who keep humor away from their untruthful, sentimental lives can fail to think of such things. For if a person should really, well, let me say, have the misfortune to have been Homer, and by a correct recognition in a later incarnation come to know that this was the case, then this realization would really appear to them, first of all, in a humorous light. Especially if it is true. It would first of all appear to them in a humorous light. You would truly laugh at yourself, first of all. It is difficult to talk about this chapter in the right way, especially in brief. But keeping the soul free and open to humor is a good way to take the serious matter really earnestly. Otherwise you debase yourself. The serious matter turns into a lie through sentimentality, and sentimentality is the worst enemy of real earnestness for the serious things of life. I can even imagine that someone who, as a foreign lady once said, only ever wants to face the serious nature of spiritual scientific cognition, quote, with a face down to the belly, close quote, might have found it objectionable that I have been talking these days about thoughts that act like a mouse in the hand. But you free yourself from the seriousness of the facts by trying to present them in such a form. For you can easily falsify the facts if you approach them with mere sentimentality, because then in sentimentality you already feel sufficiently elevated to the higher worlds and do not believe that you should also ascend to the spiritual worlds through flexible, elastic, fluid understanding. And truly it is easier to speak of the elemental world being conquered when you are, quote, unselfish, quite unselfish, close quote. Easier to get some hazy idea of the elemental world in this way, than really to make the matter so palpable that you have the transition of the thought from a dead object to a living being. Such clear characterization is what we should strive for, so that we gradually train ourselves to ascend into these spiritual worlds without any sentimentality. Don't worry, the seriousness will come. The effort arises precisely from the difficulty of acquiring spiritual science. And what matters is that we gain the strength to understand the position of the spiritual scientific worldview within present-day materialism in the right way, and through this strength to become a proper member of the spiritual scientific movement. We gain this strength in no way other than by trying to understand clearly, in the right way, how these spiritual worlds can be clothed in words, in ideas, taken from the physical world, even though the spiritual worlds themselves are so dissimilar to the physical world. Inspiration, as such, deals with those inner facts in human nature which are inherited from the evolution of the old sun, which are connected with all that makes a person capable of performing in the world that which is from heaven, that which is truly from heaven. For this, however, the human being must not only reflect on that which can be acquired in the individual life within the work of the soul, which is present between birth and death, but the human being must reflect on that which is in the hidden depths of their soul, so that the divine worlds work into their organization. The person who is to be a poet in the world must have the brain of a poet. That is, their brain must be prepared for this from the spiritual world. The person who wants to be a painter must have the brain of a painter. And in order to lend a person a painter's brain or a poet's brain, those forces and impulses must work in human nature which were already substantially there during cosmic evolution in the old sun period, and were connected with human nature when the human being themselves was not yet merely so condensed as they are on Earth, when the human being themselves had only reached the density of air. Consider that during the old sun period, human being consisted only of warmth and air. In that which works in the human being in warmth and air lies as hereditary material from the old sun period, that which can prepare the human brain in such a way that it can be a painter's brain, that it can be a poet's brain. But from this you can see how, as a result of these reflections on what is observed in the human being, and what goes out from the microcosm into the macrocosm, we must say, the human being is one with their environment through that which is the heritage of the old sun, because air and warmth are just as much outside as inside. I have often pointed out, the amount of air I have in me now is outside me in the next moment. It always goes out and in, exhale, inhale. The air has my form, and at the moment I exhale the air, it is the same air. It is then just outside, outside the human being. But as truly as my bones are myself, as truly as the shape of the air is something which is part of my own being, from the moment of inhalation to the moment of exhalation, as truly as the bones are part of me from my birth to my death, so the air current is part of me, from the moment it is inhaled to the moment it is exhaled. It is me, just as my bones are me. It is just that the air stream, being me, lasts only from inhalation to exhalation, and my bones, being me, lasts approximately from birth to death. These things are different only in terms of time. The air human being dies on exhalation and is born on inhalation. And as truly as our bones are born before our physical birth and gradually deteriorate slowly, as truly something is born in us when we breathe in, as truly something dies in us when we breathe out. That which is born in us when we breathe in dies when we breathe out. That itself belongs to the heritage from the old sun that was predisposed at that time. We see how the human realm expands into the cosmos, how the human being merges with it. But we should learn to understand how the human being lives inside the spiritual realm. Our time does not even have the talent to conceive in the most primitive way such togetherness of a human being with the spiritual realm. We have to return to that as well. It would not have occurred to a human being of ancient times to create such words as are created today when it is necessary to create a word for some composite substance. Now, at the most, chemists seek to find appropriate names according to hypothetical premises, if something is to be named according to the principles of chemistry. These names are very unpleasant for people. Sometimes they have an awful lot of syllables. Get those who are chemists among our friends, for example, to teach you about it. But where names are not given according to these principles, the names are not connected with the things. That was not always so. I spoke to you about inspiration today. I showed you how inspiration leads back to the old sun heritage of the human being. On the sun, however, the human being had come as far as breathing. That is to say, that which is now the breathing and which lives in the air element was predisposed at that time. So there must be a relationship between the breathing of the human being and inspiration. You only have to consider what the word inspiration originally actually means. In this word, the intimate relationship of breath to inspiration is already expressed, for it is basically the word for inhalation. Those who want to deny the spirits need only look at the development of language. We have already indicated this from another side. We would indeed find the spirits of language, but we would also find how these spirits of language work in human nature. Then we will find how we are embedded in the spiritual worlds, how the spirits work with us, how in everything we do in life the spirits are involved. And we will feel in a real way our self expanded to the great self of the world. What is theory will become feeling. And that is the way to really enter the spiritual worlds. But we also really need to engage with these things. We must take them in their details. We must try to take them really seriously, to be serious about much of what has just been said about the relationship of the human being to the spiritual worlds in relation to the simplest circumstances. This is what I would like to put to you particularly at the end of these lectures, which were intended to show you from a certain perspective how a descending current exists in the human being and an ascending current, and how the human being stands within the ascending and descending currents. And when Faust opens the book and utters the words, quote, "How heavenly forces ascending and descending pass golden pales from one to another," close quote, you have what I've been trying to convey to you these days, this ascending and descending of the heavenly forces, which Faust at first gawps at and cannot comprehend. But it is expressed in a way in this Faust poem that we can already see in Faust the direction in which modern times must strive. It must be no surprise to us that we want those things with our spiritual science which human beings should strive for. We have to realize that spiritual science must become a spiritual asset of humanity. And once we have reached the point of being involved in working on the coming into being of a new spiritual asset, we must do everything to realize it, to achieve this goal of humanity. And with that, I consider these reflections to be concluded for the time being. The end of Lecture 4.